Hey Weirdos, I'm scheduled for jury duty this week, and well, we never know what's going to be entailed in that kind of thing, so I'm posting some Dark Archives episodes to use until my civic duty is done. This episode is dedicated to anyone who has served on jury duty and forgot to bring something with them to read. Hopefully you can listen to Weird Darkness until the judge calls your name.
Stories and content in Weird Darkness can be disturbing for some listeners and is intended for mature audiences only. Parental discretion is strongly advised.
I tore the clothes open from the throat down. I then took a small pocket knife and opened the body, took the bowels out first, and then put them in the stove upon wood. They, being filled with air, would make a noise in exploding. So I took my knife and pricked holes through them to prevent the noise, then took out the liver and heart. I then took out the blood remaining in the cavity of the body by placing a copper kettle close to the same and cupping it out with my hands. I broke off the ribs and took out the breastbone and threw it into the large boiler, unjointed the arms and the shoulders, doubled them up and placed them in the boiler. Then served the remaining portions of the body by placing a stick of wood under her back and breaking the backbone over the same, cutting away the flesh and ligaments with a knife. I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness.
Welcome, Weirdos. I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness. Here you'll find stories of the paranormal, supernatural, legends, lore, crime, conspiracy, mysterious, macabre, unsolved, and unexplained. If you're new here, welcome to the show. And if you're listening on the radio or on a streaming station, be sure to subscribe to the podcast, too. I upload episodes 7 days a week. And if you're already a member of our Weirdo family, please take a moment and invite a friend, family member, or co-worker to listen in. Recommending Weird Darkness to others helps make it possible for me to keep doing the show. And while you're listening, be sure to check out WeirdDarkness.com, where you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Minds, MeWe, and more, along with the Weird Darkness Weirdos Facebook group. Coming up in this episode, it's a special Dark Archives episode of Weird Darkness, where I reach back into the archives and bring out some dark and strange stories you might not have heard yet, as they are from several years ago. Now, bolt your doors, lock your windows, turn off your lights, and come with me into this Dark Archives episode of Weird Darkness.
Do you dare to enter through the gateway to hell? At the Phrygian city of Hierapolis in southwest Turkey, there is a sacred ancient site dedicated to Pluto, the Roman god of the underworld. This site's name is Plutonium, and the place is also known as Pluto's Gate. Deadly vapors still emerge from Pluto's Gate that in ancient times was considered a gateway to hell. Mentioned by several ancient writers such as Roman statesman Cicero and the Greek geographer Strabo, Plutonium was long treated as nothing but an ancient myth. But scientists have been able to confirm these ancient stories are based on real events that our ancestors witnessed. This space is full of a vapor so misty and dense that one can scarcely see the ground. Any animal that passes inside meets instant death. The Greek geographer Strabo wrote, "I threw in sparrows, and they immediately breathed their last and fell." Some archaeologists have suspected this particular gateway to hell existed somewhere amid the ancient ruins at Hierapolis, but had been unable to find its exact location. Today, Greco-Roman mythology experts now agree Strabo and other writers were right. The Pluto's Gate is real and still dangerous. A while back, archaeologist and professor of classic archaeology at the University of Salento Francesco d'Andria and his team discovered a small cave in the ancient city of the Phrygian city Hierapolis, which is now Pamukkale. Soon, researchers determined the cave and announced they had found Pluto's gate. "We found the plutonium by reconstructing the route of a thermal spring. Indeed, Pamukkale springs, which produce the famous white travertine terraces, originated from this cave. We could see the cave's lethal properties during the excavation. Several birds died as they tried to get close to the warm opening. Instantly killed by the carbon dioxide fumes," the Andrea said. It is correct that deadly gases still emerge from what ancient people called Pluto's Gate, but the cave is a natural phenomenon, and similar openings in the Earth's crust can be found elsewhere. These are mephitic gases, named for the ancient Samnite goddess Mephiti, and undoubtedly we find the coolest, a modern-day Hell Gate in Turkmenistan. The giant Darveza crater, nicknamed Door to Hell, has been on fire when geologists accidentally opened it while looking for natural gas. The oracle at Delphi, near the Temple of Apollo, is associated with Pythia, the sanctuary's priestess who was seated in a state of trance, speaking on the behalf of the gods, delivering her prophecies, and advised rulers, citizens, and philosophers of everything from their sex lives to affairs of state. One aspect of the ancient oracle at Delphi, which has fascinated scholars, scientists, and laymen alike, is the nature and cause of the trance state attained by Pythia. Was Pythia a fake, or was she under the influence of something? Numerous classical authors report that natural phenomena played an essential part in one of their most sacred religious rituals, the Oracle at Delphi. Once again, many years later, it became evident that ancient writers were telling the truth. Scientists discovered the existence of the crossed fault lines and the presence of an intoxicating gas called ethylene in the rocks below the ancient temple. The presence of hydrocarbon gases can induce a narcotic state, similar to that recorded from the trance state of Pythia. So basically, it would mean Pythia was on drugs when she delivered the messages from the gods. Perhaps we tend to dismiss ancient stories too fast, labeling them as myths. Proper scientific investigations can shed more light on what events really took place in the past. I've had my fair share of sightings while growing up in the historic town of Bailey's Prairie, Texas. But the one that sticks out in my mind, and one I've made a ritual to tell every year at Halloween, is my run-in with Mr. Britt Bailey. The story goes that if you drive down Highway 36 between Angleton and West Columbia around midnight, you'll see a glowing ball of light roaming around the prairie. And that, of course, is Old Man Bailey, looking for the whiskey bottle that his loving wife refused to bury with him. I personally have seen Mr. Bailey's light a dozen times while driving through the area. But one night was different. It was a cold and foggy October night, and though I never made it a habit to be out after nightfall, this night brought circumstances out of my control. It was midnight, and I was driving in such fog that I couldn't see a foot in front of me. Then, out of nowhere, a deer darted out in front of my car. I slammed on the brakes, and my car began to spin out of control. Round and round it went until finally it came to a stop. As I gathered myself together, although still very shook up, I realized I was out in a field somewhere. I fearfully tried to restart my stalled car, but to no avail. I had no choice but to get out of my car and try to find a road, and hopefully someone to help me. As I stepped out, I looked around and saw nothing but an old cemetery. I had almost driven through the fence of the old Bailey's Prairie Cemetery, which is located right off the road but is nowhere near any homes. Tears welled up in my eyes as I realized I had no idea what to do. Then I saw it. Bailey's light. Fear overcame me. Yes, I had seen the light before, but that was from the safety of my moving car. This light was right in front of me. I was frozen. I couldn't speak. I couldn't move. The light was about as big as a basketball. It looked like someone was holding a flashlight, yet no one was there. It began to circle me, and then my car. I slowly began to walk sideways and then turned and ran back inside my car, locking the doors behind me. As I looked around, I couldn't see the light anymore. It had vanished. Still shaking and scared, I tried to start my car one more time, and to my disbelief, it started. I quickly turned the car around, got back on the road, and headed home. The next day, after a few hours of sleep, I began to wonder, how did my car start after being totally dead? Did old man Bailey come to help me? I realize now that I'll truly never know what happened that night. 25 years later, the incident still remains a mystery to me, but it has definitely added some more character to my annual Halloween stories. In some myths of the Algonquin tribes of North America, there is a creature, the Wendigo, that takes different forms. It is a cannibal, a monster. When there's nothing left to eat, it starves to death. When it sees something, it wants to own it. No one else can have anything. This illness feeds on a spiritual void. The Wendigo is a danger that surrounds us. It is not only a creature from myths and legends of the ancients. The Algonquin Native Americans represent the most extensive and numerous North American groups, with hundreds of tribes speaking several related dialects of the language group Algonquian. They lived in most of the Canadian territory below the Hudson Bay and between the Atlantic Ocean and the Rocky Mountains. Their rich mythology and their beliefs survived many generations, and so did the Wendigo, a monster, and bogeyman. This cannibal monster, also known as Wendigo or even Wejigo, is an evil, man-eating spirit. However, his abilities and evil doings vary, depending on the locality of where the legends were gathered. Generally, the Wendigo has certain characteristics of a human or an evil spirit. By possessing a human being, the Wendigo can change his or her to become a cannibal. The Wendigo, a malevolent, supernatural being, is associated with cannibalism, murder, and voracious greed, and this kind of behavior has always been condemned in these indigenous communities. In some myths and legends of the Algonquin-speaking peoples, those who commit sins such as selfishness, greed, or cannibalism are turned into a Wendigo as punishment. Among the peoples of Canada, around the Barrens Lake, located in Manitoba, Canada, along the eastern shore of Lake Winnipeg, the Wendigo is an amphibious being like an alligator with bear's feet or cloven hooves. In the beliefs of the Chippewa Indians, also known as the Ojibwe, this evil creature is an ogre which is focused on children to obtain their compliant behavior. Along with other indigenous tribes such as Eastern Cree, West Main Swampy Cree, Naskapi, and Innu, the Ojibwe describe the Wendigo as a giant, many times larger than human beings. In Algonquin folklore, however, the Wendigo is the spirit of a lost hunter, who now mercilessly preys upon humans in a cannibalistic manner. The Wendigo is never happy. He is never satisfied with his killings and consuming of the bodies. He is constantly searching for new victims. His hunger is limitless. As I said earlier, when there is nothing left to eat, it starves to death. When it sees something, it wants to own it. No one else can have anything. This illness feeds on a spiritual void. The Wendigo is a danger that surrounds us.
There's more of this special Dark Hives episode of Weird Darkness still to come. When I was younger, I tended to put all of myself into what I enjoy doing, but I began feeling the consequences of living like that when I hit my 40s. Fortunately, my bad back and aching knee, they're not an issue now because I use CBD oils. I've been a proponent for CBD oil for years, but now I'm able to not only introduce it to you, but also give you a discount on it. My friends at Extract Labs have set it up for you to get anything and everything on their website for 15% off. Just use the promo code WEIRD15 at checkout. Studies have shown that CBD can help with depression in many cases as well. It certainly has for me. I've also started using CBG oil as well, and I take the capsules that combine both CBD and CBG, so I'm covered with one gel capsule. But there are numerous ways to use CBD oils – bath bombs, body rubs, muscle creams, face creams, candy bars, powders for cooking, and more. They even have products specifically to help your pets. Plus, all of their products come THC-free, so you don't have to worry about psychoactive properties like other hemp-related products. If you're a CBD user already, or if it's something you just want to try, visit WeirdDarkness.com/CBD and take a look at all the products available. That's WeirdDarkness.com/CBD. And remember, use the promo code WEIRD15, all one word, at checkout, and you can save 15% on your entire purchase. That's WeirdDarkness.com/CBD, and then use the promo code WEIRD15 at checkout. Every month, one email newsletter subscriber is chosen at random to win a Weird Darkness prize pack. You could be my next winner. Sign up for the newsletter for free at WeirdDarkness.com.
In 1995, author Daniel Cohen wrote Something Strange and Horrible Happened in a Number of American Households of the Early Republic. In a series of curiously clustered incidents, a handful of men, loving husbands and affectionate fathers, took axes from under their beds or off their mantelpiece and slaughtered their wife and children. The public was transfixed by these bloody tragedies, even though they were fairly rare, until the early decades of the 19th century, when the rate of wife murder increased fivefold throughout the North, according to Karen Haltinen, a professor of history at the University of Southern California. At the same time, printed accounts of family murders began to appear with increasing frequency. Such stories offered detailed descriptions of butchery that bordered on the obscene. Those who believe that today's popular culture is usually graphic in its depictions of violence might consider this passage from an 1857 true crime book called The Triple Murderer. It recounted the crimes of a Midwestern killer named Reuben Ward. After he killed his wife, Olive, on their family farm, he then disposed of the corpse in the most grisly, although efficient, way imaginable. I tore the clothes open from the throat down. I then took a small pocket knife and opened the body, took the bowels out first, and then put them in the stove upon wood. They being filled with air would make a noise in exploding, so I took my knife and pricked holes through them to prevent the noise. Then took out the liver and heart. I then took out the blood remaining in the cavity of the body by placing a copper kettle close to the same and cupping it out with my hands. I broke off the ribs and took out the breastbone and threw it into the large boiler, unjointing the arms at the shoulders, doubled them up and placed them in the boiler, then severed the remaining portions of the body by placing a stick of wood under her back and breaking the backbone over the same, cutting away the flesh and ligaments with a knife. According to crime historians, men who committed family homicide during this period were generally driven by an intolerable sense of mortification that they had somehow failed in the eyes of society and their families. By the middle 1800s, increasingly high expectations had been placed on married men. It was no longer enough just to have a house. One had to have a nice house. Having a job was no longer enough. A man had to have an upwardly rising career that would support a wife and children in comfort. Husbands were expected to be more than just good providers. They had to be sober, upstanding, and respectable. When men could not meet the expectations placed on them by society, they often turned on those closest to them, their wives and families, who were the most persistent reminders of their failures. The rise of the so-called family annihilators began in the late 1700s when formerly loving fathers and husbands hideously slaughtered their families in a sudden fit of homicidal frenzy. Perhaps the most infamous of these nightmarish figures was a man named William Beadle, the perpetrator of what one contemporary report called a crime more atrocious and horrible than any ever committed in New England, and scarcely exceeded in the history of man. William Beadle was born in England in 1730 and immigrated to America at the age of 32. He settled in the village of Wethersfield, Connecticut, where he operated a country store that was regarded as having a handsome assortment of goods. Beadle enjoyed early success, which must have enhanced his initial view of himself. Even though he was a quiet man with unprepossessing looks, he thought of himself as far superior to the ordinary run of humanity. In one journal entry, he wrote, "My person is small and mean to look on, my circumstances were always narrow, which were great disadvantages in the world, but I have great reason to think my soul is above the common mold." In his mind, he believed himself to be a diamond among millions of pebbles. His business thrived for several years. Very proud of his success, he maintained a handsome farm outside of town and entertained his guests in great style. His neighbors held him in high esteem. They saw him as an honorable tradesman, a generous host, a loving husband, and a proud father. In the years that immediately followed the Revolutionary War, however, Beadle suffered a number of reverses that left him in dire financial straits. Unable to bear the idea of being thought of as being poor and dependent, he struggled to keep up the outward appearance of his former situation. Eventually, it became too much for him, and he succumbed to his despair. The thought of being perceived as a failure by his neighbors was more than he could tolerate. He wrote, "If a man who once lived well, meant well, and done well, falls by unavoidable accident into poverty and submits to be laughed at, despised, and trampled on by a set of mean wretches as far below him as the moon is below the sun, I say, if such a man submits, he must become meaner than meanness itself." Deciding that suicide was less shameful than poverty, he decided to kill himself and his family. Like so many others before and after him who committed acts of horror, he justified his intended atrocity as prompted by kindness, even love. He wrote in his journal, "I mean to close the eyes of six persons through perfect humanity and the most endearing fondness and friendship, for mortal father never felt more of these tender ties than myself." At first, he thought he might spare his wife. After much deliberation, though, he concluded that it would be cruel to leave her behind to languish out a life of misery and wretchedness. If she was faced with having to mourn the loss of her entire family, death would undoubtedly be merciful. As he began to formulate his plan, he kept hoping that Providence would turn up something to prevent it, if the intent were wrong. Instead, he saw that every circumstance served to convince him that destroying his family was the only logical course. For a while, he prayed each night that his 12-year-old son and three young daughters might be killed accidentally, thus sparing him the necessity of taking their lives. To facilitate that end, he removed the protective wooden cover from the well in the backyard and encouraged them to swim in the deepest and most treacherous parts of the river. When the children survived these dangers, stubbornly clinging to life, Beadle resolved to take more direct action. uncertain at first how and when to carry out this great affair, as he described the planned massacre, he had no doubt that he would not falter when the time came. He wrote, "How I shall really perform the task I have undertaken, I know not till the moment arrives, but I believe I shall perform it deliberately and as steadily as I would go to supper or to bed." He eventually decided on November 18th as the day he would kill his family. "He first procured a noble supper of oysters, that my family and I may eat and drink together, thank God, and then die." He was forced to abandon this plan, however, when the maid, who had been sent away on an errand, returned unexpectedly. A few weeks later, he made another aborted attempt, which he described in his journal. "On the morning of the 6th of December, I rose before the sun, felt calm, and left my wife between sleep and wake, went into the room where my infants lay, found them all sound asleep. The means of death were with me, but I had not before determined whether to strike or not, but yet thought it was a good opportunity. I stood over them and asked my God whether it was right or not now to strike, but no answer came. Not, I believe, ever does to a man while on earth. I then examined myself. There was neither fear, trembling, nor horror about me. I then went into a chamber next to that to look at myself in the glass, but I could discover no alteration in my countenance of feelings. This is true as God reigns, but for further trial I yet postponed it." 5 days later, in the early morning hours of December 11, 1782, Beadle finally carried out his bloody act. Slipping into the second-floor bedchamber, shared by his four children and the housemaid, he shook the latter awake and then ordered her to rise gently without disturbing the children and come downstairs with him. When she appeared a few minutes later, he handed her a note to give to the family's physician, Dr. Farnsworth, who lived a short distance away. Beadle told her that his wife had been ill all night. The maid was to go straight to Farnsworth's home at once, give him the note, and remain there until the doctor returned to the Beadle house with her. As soon as the maid left on this imaginary errand, Beadle hurried into his bedroom, where he had already stashed a freshly sharpened axe and carving knife. He slipped to the edge of the bed and swung the axe with a swift hand, smashing his sleeping wife's skull. He then slit her throat with the knife, taking care to drain the blood into a pitcher so that it did not stain the bedsheets. After covering her face with a cloth, he went to the children's room and killed all of them in the same way. He left his little boy lying in bed, while the slaughtered girls were placed side by side on the floor, like little lambs, covered with a blanket. Leaving a trail of blood behind him on the stairs, Beadle went down to the kitchen, where he placed the axe and knife, reeking with the blood of his family, on the table. He then seated himself in a chair next to the fireplace. Several weeks earlier, in preparation for this moment, he had taken his two flintlock pistols to the village gunsmith for repair. He now took a pistol in each hand, and, bracing his elbows on the arms of the chair, he pressed the muzzles against his ears and pulled both triggers at the same time, splattering his brains against the walls and wainscoting. By then, Dr. Farnsworth had been roused from his sleep, and the Beadle's maid had handed him the note which announced the diabolical purpose of the writer. Even though Farnsworth found it impossible to believe that any man would adopt so horrible a design, he immediately alerted his neighbor, the Honorable Stephen Mix Mitchell, who later became Chief Justice of the state and wrote an account of the atrocity in 1805. The two men rushed to the Beadle house, where they were greeted by the tragic scene. Soon, the news of the massacre had spread to the village. Men, women, and children flocked to the Beadle house for a look at the carnage. The scene was described by Judge Mitchell in an account that became one of the best-selling true crime pamphlets of its day. The very inmost souls of the beholders were wounded at the sight and torn by contending passions. Silent grief with marks of astonishment were succeeded by furious indignation against the author of the affecting spectacle, which vented itself incoherent exclamations. Some old soldiers accidentally passing through the town that morning on their way from camp to visit their friends, led by curiosity, turned into view the sad remains. On sight of the woman and her tender offspring, notwithstanding all their firmness, the tender sympathetic tear stealing gently down their furrowed cheeks betrayed the anguish of their hearts. On being showed the body of the sacrifice, they paused for a moment, then muttered forth an oath or two of execration, with their eyes fixed on the ground in silent sorrow. They slowly went their way. So awful and terrible a disaster wrought wonderfully on the minds of the neighborhood. Nature itself seemed ruffled and refused the kindly aid of balmy sleep for a time. The people of Wethersfield shared the old soldier's anger with Beadle, refusing to allow him a Christian burial in the local churchyard. Tying the bloody carving knife to his chest, they dragged him on a small sled to the riverbank, dug a grave in unconsecrated ground, and tossed his ragged body into the hole, like the carcass of a beast. A few days later, after deciding that the site was too close to the ferry landing, a few locals dug up the corpse and moved it with utmost secrecy to an obscure spot. Despite their precautions, some children discovered the place, and the body was exhumed again and moved to yet another spot, where it is hoped mankind will have no further vexation with it. In contrast to the way that the wicked murderer's corpse was treated, the funeral for his victims was a ceremonious affair. One observer wrote, "The remains of the children were borne by a suitable number of equal age, attended with a sad procession of youths of the town, all bathed in tears. Side by side, the hapless woman's corpse was carried in solemn procession to the parish churchyard, followed by a great concourse who, with affectionate concern and every token of respect, were anxious to express their heartfelt sorrow in performing the last mournful duties." Even though William Beadle was denied a decent burial or any marker for his forgotten grave, he was granted a kind of immortality in the form of a widely circulated broadside ballad, illustrated with a woodcut of a knife-wielding beetle stalking his innocent children. The murder ballad of William Beadle fits easily into the category of a poorly constructed verse that was composed to take advantage of the public's thirst for horror. The verse written in his honor is as follows. "A bloody scene I'll now relate, which lately happened in a neighboring state. A murder of the deepest dye, I say. Oh, be amazed, for surely well you may. A man, unworthy of name, who slew himself, his consort, and his offspring too. An amiable wife with four children dear into one grave was put. Oh, drop a tear. Soon in the morning of the fatal day, Beadle, the murderer, sent his maid away to tell the awful deed he had in view. To their assistance, the kind neighbors flew. It truly gives me pain for to pen down a deed so black, and yet his mind was sound. Says he, I meant to close six persons' eyes through perfect fondness and the tenderest ties. Detest the errors to this deed him drew, and mourn the hapless victims whom he slew, and pray to God that Satan be bound, since to deceive so many he is found. Fly swiftly round, ye circling years, hail the auspicious day, when love shall dwell in every heart, nor men their offspring slay." About 15 years ago, I helped my boyfriend move into his first home. It was a one-bedroom flat. It was in a dingy building, but it was his first place, and we thought it was exciting. As you opened the front door, there was a long hallway with a door to your right, the bathroom. Further down the hallway, another door to your left, which led to the bedroom. And straight ahead, at the very end, was a doorway to the kitchen or sitting room. There was no door, though, just the empty frame. I always felt as though someone stood in that doorway, with their hands on the top of the frame, swinging as in a playful way, staring at me. I didn't like the feeling, and my boyfriend always agreed something felt wrong. We both felt it was female, nevertheless I learned to live with it. I always kept the hallway light on, always woke him up in the night when I needed to go to the bathroom, and generally avoided moving around in that doorway. Several months passed, and things got moved. The TV would switch channels for no reason. Grunting noises and deep gasps of breath would be heard. One night I was taking a bath and saw a shadow of a man on the wall opposite the bath. It moved and flickered as though it were cast by a candle. I have never been so freaked out by anything in my life. Later, we were in the center of town where we met an old friend who had lived in the area for quite a while who began to tell us about the previous tenants. A student couple had lived there and one of them had hung themselves in the kitchen doorway, which was why there was no door in the frame. Hence the feeling of someone there with their hands up on the doorway, swinging. Freaky stuff. Well, we moved out shortly after, and ever since then, we keep having strange things happen, even to this day. Whatever was there followed us. When I was 15, I had a series of strange things happen to me at home. Every night, I would read before going to sleep. This one particular night was the same as usual. I'd turn on my radio, pop open a book, and gradually fall asleep. But something was different as I woke up for no reason around 3 or 4 in the morning, only to see two entities quietly standing on the right side of my bed. My radio was still on, and my book was lying on my chest. I could see them quite clearly as they seemed to glow. I didn't feel scared, but I felt confused, and I was thinking to myself, is this actually happening? The beings were blacker than the actual dark, but seemed to have glowing edges. They were small, but I could tell they were not children, and they wore clothes. The one closest to me wore a hat and the other a dress or something with no other discernible features. When the entities noticed that I had seen them, they started blinking out. That's the best way I can describe it, almost as though they were changing color. Then, in a matter of seconds, they ran into my closet. I remember not being scared, only confused and disbelieving what I had just witnessed. A few days later, I started to tell my dad what I had seen in my room, and he cut me off by asking if I was talking about the shadow people. I told him I had. He told me that he saw them in the kitchen at times, but to his eyes, they were completely solid. I saw these entities several times, and still do from time to time. They've never tried to contact me or scare me. I get the feeling that they are trapped in this house. I don't think they're self-aware either. They seem to replay the same situation over and over in a loop. In my bedroom, they look towards me and run into the closet. Downstairs, they stand in the door and stare until they fade away. On the stairs, they just stand and look either up the stairway or down the stairway, depending on whether they are standing at the top or the bottom of the stairwell. I wonder sometimes if these entities are actually just a scene played over and over again. A time loop? I've never seen them change their routine. Has anyone else ever seen this sort of thing? In this episode, we return to the reviews on TripAdvisor.com and to a place called The Townhouse in Durham, England. It appears that one couple celebrating their wedding anniversary had an experience they might like to forget. My partner and I stayed for our anniversary, for one night. We booked the nautical room, which was very cramped, especially for the price we paid. The location is very central and ideal for seeing Durham. Overall, the hotel is well furnished and maintained. However, one word of warning, the room we stayed in was haunted. I must be the most skeptical person in the world, never believed in such things. However, clear as day, a figure was next to the bed, definitely not associated with any alcohol, after my partner felt someone or something in the room. I turned to give her assurance, in a kind word, and through the glow of the luminous fire escape sticker on the door was a figure with a 1920s maid's hat holding what appeared to be a tray. I double-taked, and it was still there. Needless to say, the lights we turned on, and we lay awake until daylight to open the curtains. Now, before you start thinking we're a pair of nutters, we mentioned this to some staff who were in the room adjacent as we were leaving. We told them we had seen something, and before even we said where, the exact words were, "Don't tell me, the nautical room." Needless to say, this left us speechless. We were then told that within the past weeks, Gad's townhouse had had spiritualists, paranormal investigators, and even a priest in. As we checked out, we mentioned the events to the manager, who dismissed us. But next to her was a young lady working, and she spoke up and asked if we stayed in the nautical room. The manager hastily retraced and said there had been a few issues and complaints about the room. I would have preferred to be advised of this prior to booking. I would have expected a discount for our terrible experience, but no, we just paid and were out by 9 a.m. Stayed May 2012, traveled as a couple. Looking for a discount for a haunted room? Many people would pay extra.
Keep listening. There's more of this special Dark Hives episode of Weird Darkness on the way. Hey, Weirdos! Weird Darkness has been nominated for a podcast award in 4 categories this year: Storyteller Drama, Society and Culture, True Crime, and the coveted People's Choice category. You can vote for Weird Darkness in all 4 categories at the same time by visiting podcastawards.com. Once you sign up to vote, you'll find all 4 categories in the left-hand column, People's Choice at the very top, and then bottom left-hand column for the remaining 3 when you scroll down. While it's still on your mind right now, please, go vote! Only you, my weirdo family, can help Weird Darkness become an award-winning podcast this year. Go to podcastawards.com and vote for Weird Darkness in the Storyteller Drama category, the Society and Culture category, the True Crime category, and the People's Choice category. And thank you, Weirdo Family, for nominating and voting for Weird Darkness. If you like Weird Darkness, you'll want to also listen to some of the free audiobooks I've narrated, with titles by Stephen King, H.P. Lovecraft, Charles Dickens, and more. Check out all the audiobooks I've narrated on the audiobooks page at WeirdDarkness.com. My dad told me this creepy story several times when I was growing up. His childhood wasn't so great, and so he liked to escape at weekends or whatever he could. His best friend, Jack, and he loved to cycle, camp, and hike around East Yorkshire, and that's what they did just any time they could. It was the years directly after the war, and there was little traffic or other people to bother them. One night, they pitched their small 2-man tent in a farmer's field near Long Marston. They knew very well that, in the vicinity many years ago, a battle had taken place there during the English Civil War, the Battle of Marston Moor. It was partly why they were there, as they both had a love of history as well as the outdoors. They retired as dusk came, as they were heading back in the morning and needed to get up early to allow sufficient time for the trip. Cycling all day is tiring, and so they had no problems sleeping.
Around 1 a.m., a hand shaking his shoulder woke my dad up. It was pitch black. As he awoke, he heard Jack's voice. "Nev, Nev, do you hear that?" Dad listened, and to his amazement, he could hear the thudding of horses galloping, men shouting and screaming, and the clash of steel on steel. This was taking place in a thunderstorm and was accompanied by the sound of rain, thunder, and huge flashes of lightning. He was horrified. The two of them sat in the dark, listening to what he described as a cacophony of battle sounds all around their little tent in the field. They dare not move. They dare not look outside the tent. They simply sat there, wide-eyed with cold sweat dribbling down their icy cold necks, listening to the sounds of a Civil War battle in a thunderstorm going on around them. As soon as the dawn began to break, the sounds faded. They got up, skipped breakfast, and got out of there as soon as they could. The field was totally empty when they finally summoned up the courage to leave the tent. The experience obviously had a big impact on him because he would often tell my brothers and I the tale of the night the Battle of Marston Moor took place. I think what had shocked him more was that when checking up on the battle years later, he discovered that it did actually take place in a thunderstorm. When I was a child, I lived in a rural part of the country. Our house was perfectly fine, but the next door house had a series of strange events happen that could be called paranormal. During the 1800s, a man had murdered his family in that house. Then he had committed suicide. After that, few people had wanted to stay in the house, and people always told of blood running under the crack of the door. From time to time, we would hear noises from next door. Crying, sometimes banging, sometimes tapping. It was nothing extreme, but a family moved in and they started redecorating the house. After a few days, the wife of the family who moved in knocked on our door and asked if we knew anything about the house. My mother told her everything she knew. She mentioned the murders, the blood running under the steps, the suicide, everything she knew. She told us that the first night they'd stayed in that house, her husband had seen a face in the wall, an actual face morph from the wall and stretch across the room. My mother thought she was a little crazy and just smiled. She went home, and we got on with our lives. A few weeks later, the neighbor's wife up and left. She went home. She left her husband with the kids. He told us that she was taking a break and wanted to visit her parents. Nobody thought any more about the situation until one night we woke up and heard the father screaming outside. One of his children had taken to sleepwalking and had wandered off. You have to keep in mind that in the rural parts of our country, people rarely lock their doors. My father and the oldest son next door went off to look for the girl who had gone missing. My mother comforted the man, and eventually they found the girl wandering down the road. A few weeks after that, he was complaining to my dad about the house being cold. He wanted to install heating, but he wasn't sure if the walls could take all the work he would have to do to install it. He said the rooms were icy cold. We lived in a similar house, and my dad said we had no such problems. He went into the house and came out in agreement. Something was wrong. It was too cold, and there were no real reasons for it to be that cold. Our dog once ran into the house and started growling when he went upstairs. He wouldn't enter any of the rooms. He just stood on the landing and growled. The oldest boy told me that the TV would randomly switch channels, the lights would burn out, the fuse box would trip. There would be footsteps on the stairs that would end halfway up the stairs. Apparently, the house was a hive of activity. The father called a medium because he was sure the house was haunted. The medium told them that there were over 50 spirits in that house. One of the most active was a man who had blood on his hands. Apparently, the house was crawling with them, but this one spirit was the strongest. He suggested a cleansing, and apparently it did the trick. You won't learn about this incident online, though. I don't think it was well known, but it did take place. I could tell more stories about that place, too.
Thanks for listening to this special Dark Hives episode of Weird Darkness. If you like the show, please share it with someone you know who loves the paranormal or strange stories, true crime, monsters, or unsolved mysteries like you do. And if you've not done so already, be sure to subscribe to the podcast. I upload episodes 7 days a week. If you want to reach out to me, you can email me anytime with your questions or comments at Darren@WeirdDarkness.com. That's Darren. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Minds, MeWe, and you can join the Weirdos Facebook group on the Contact Social page at WeirdDarkness.com. While on the website, if you have a true paranormal or creepy tale to tell, click on Tell Your Story to email it to me. Or tell your story by phone by calling the Dark Line toll-free at 1-877-277-5944. That's 1-877-277-5944. All stories in Weird Darkness are purported to be true unless stated otherwise, and you can find source links or links to the authors in the show notes. Weird Darkness is a production of Marler House Productions. Copyright Weird Darkness 2021. I'm Darren Marler. Thanks for joining me in this special Dark Hives episode of Weird Darkness. Have you checked out the brand new Monster Channel? It has horror hosts, B-horror movies, retro television commercials, and a whole lot more. You can watch it anytime, 24/7, 365, on the Monster Channel page at WeirdDarkness.com. It's also where we hold our Weirdo Watch Parties each month. Get your monster movie fix on the Monster Channel at WeirdDarkness.com.